Well, this message has been a long time coming. It was back in, early 1996, when the UCG had just formed. Our local minister at the time was Roy Dove, and he used to drive up from Bloomfield, I think, New Mexico, every week to be our pastor. But he said he was going to speak on this subject. And so I put it off. I was only doing sermonettes at the time, and maybe it's a more involved subject than a sermonette would call for anyway, but he never got to do it. So today I'm going to get around to it. After all these years, it's a subject that has a very wide interest to a lot of Christian denominations. It's a subject that, to some degree, factors into many, many different Protestant religions. Subject called predestination. The primary proponent of this understanding was a fellow called John Calvin. And many people know his theology by his name. It's called Calvinism, or Calvinistic thought. His basic position was that a person had no choice about being called of God. There are those who are destined to be called, and there are those who are not. John Calvin was an influential French theologian and pastor during the Protestant Reformation. He was a principal figure in the development of the system of Christian theology, later called Calvinism. Originally trained as a humanist lawyer, he broke from the Roman Catholic Church around 1530, and this is roughly in the ballpark of the Martin Luther era also. Calvin's writing and preachings provided the seeds for the branch of theology that bears his name. The Reformed Church, the Congregational Church, and the Presbyterian churches, which looked to Calvin as the chief expositor of their beliefs, have spread throughout the world. And Calvinistic thinking is accepted to some degree by Methodists and Lutheranism to some degree. And I say to some degree because there is an element of that thinking that has worked its way into most of Christianity. Calvinism is based on what we could call a seedbed of the Catholic Church or Catholic theology. For example, many of us have heard of or even read Dante Alighieri's Divine Comedy. I think most of us have heard of Dante's Inferno. He wasn't the originator of those ideas, but he basically put to writing the prevailing thought of his time. And it's somewhat from that theological era, that theological mindset, that the Calvinistic thought developed. Let me read to you some of his theology. And this you can find online. That's where I found most of this. But according to John Calvin, predestination is God's unchangeable decree from before the creation of the world that he would freely save some people, the elect, foreordaining them to eternal life, while the others would be barred from access to salvation and sentenced to eternal death. Calvin described the basis of predestination in several ways. In general, he affirmed that there is no basis for election outside of God, referring to Ephesians 1:9, and we'll go to that in a few minutes. But referring to Ephesians 1:9, Calvin noted that God purposed election in himself, basing his decree of predestination on nothing outside of himself. Calvin attributed the salvation of the elect to God's free decision to favor them. Now, when we think of John 6:44, we can see that there is an element there which would tend to support that position. But there's more to the story. Calvin attributed the salvation of the elect to God's free decision to favor them. He variously described this as God's mere generosity, His freely given mercy, and the good pleasure of His will. Moreover, Calvin based the damnation of the reprobate solely in God's decision. In other words, a person had no choice about whether they were to be called or not. And a person who desired to be called, that God had not deemed or predestined to calling, had no chance whatsoever to pursue conversion. This is the Calvinistic thinking. You can see how severe it could be. But there's a number of things that we need to look at. Let me continue a little more here. Since God's reasons for predestination are wholly internal to His being, they are opaque to humanity. In other words, we couldn't possibly understand God's reasoning. Ultimately, then, the basis of God's predestination is mysterious and utterly incomprehensible to people. This mystery points to one of God's purposes in predestination, to inspire wonder and reverence in believers. The things hidden in God are not to be understood by people, but rather revered in their wonderful depth. Despite the mysterious basis of predestination, it is possible for the elect to be certain of their status as children of God. The first and seemingly most important indicator of election is what Calvin referred to as the calling of God. His use of the term seems to refer to a subjective inward certainty that God has chosen a person for salvation. Salvation, according to Calvin, is God's choice, not your own. Think about that. John Calvin also defined his doctrine of predestination in opposition to differing views held by his contemporaries. First, Calvin took up the view that God predestines people according to His foreknowledge of their works. While Calvin affirmed the foreknowledge of God, he denied that God adopts as sons those whom He foreknows will not be worthy of His grace, and damns those He knows will be inclined to evil intention and ungodliness. From Ephesians 1:4, he argued that one purpose of God's election was to make His children holy. Second, Calvin took up the view that God elects some but condemns none. You can see his obvious problem there. Calvin saw this view as highly absurd, since it seemed to imply that the salvation received by the elect could also be attained by the non-elect as a result of chance or their own effort. Rejecting this inconsistent implication, Calvin asserted that the reprobate are those God intentionally neglects to choose. From Romans 9:14, Calvin argued that the hardening of non-elect hearts is as much attributable to God as is mercy. Kind of profound in its own way, because this kind of thinking is alleging that humanity has no choice, number one, in being converted, and number two, in their ultimate destiny. And that is compounded when you think that the vast majority of humanity, and think for a minute outside of our culture, the vast majority of humanity throughout history has not been converted. And most of them are already in their graves and would never have such an opportunity if Calvin's thinking is correct. Now, in some of what I read to you, you might have seen elements that we would, to some degree, accept with certain qualification. And I'll come to that in a few minutes. But what's wrong with this thinking? We can notice just intellectually that Calvinism is particularly severe with respect to the exclusion of the greater humanity. It provides no opportunity, no chance, no choice for most who have ever lived. That would have to be the conclusion of a Calvinistic religion's doctrine or denomination. And think about this. There is a vast number of people who died in infancy or who died as little children, who even if they had a chance would never have been able to comprehend what conversion means. They wouldn't be able to even think about repenting because they couldn't conceive of it. Calvinism is particularly severe with respect to the exclusion of greater humanity. But there's another thing to consider. It makes God out to be insensitive. He cares about the few, and he has no loving regard whatsoever for the rest. Would a loving God allow so many to be eternally tortured in an ever-burning hell for something that they had no choice about whatsoever? That's what a person would have to believe. Now, we know the answer, and I'm going to get there. But I want to present these things hopefully from the point of view of someone who even accepted that kind of religion. This is some of the things that they have to think about. Predestination, as it's understood and as it's taught, undermines the whole basis of judgment. Why would God judge those people that had no choice? What would be the basis of that judgment? How could it be just to condemn someone who had no choice? Another thing, that kind of theology disregards God's basic intent. He says in 2 Peter 3:9 that he is not willing that any should perish. How does that square with the idea that the majority have no chance to pursue conversion because they weren't predestined to be called? God is not willing that any should perish. Now, we know he has a plan that no one need perish unnecessarily, but Calvinism doesn't make room for that. That teaching also fails to realize that there are two harvests of humanity. What is known as the early and latter rains. Now, I remember as a kid in a Baptist church hearing about the early and latter rains. And some ministries do teach that kind of thing. Now, most of them see the early and latter rains as being this present harvest and then a great mass of humanity that comes to God when the tribulation gets going. And I can understand that point of view. But there's actually more to it than that. In James 5:7, there is a reference to this. And keep in mind that James was writing to people who already understood this phenomenon. James 5:7. He says, "Be patient, therefore, brethren, unto the coming of the Lord. Behold, the husbandman," referring to the Lord, "waits for the precious fruit of the earth." He is harvesting the earth, and he has long patience for it until he receives the early and the latter rain. Those of us who understand the biblical holy days will see the comparison between the early and the latter rain. We understand that there are two harvests of humanity. The first is pictured by the spring holy days, the smaller harvest of the year. But the greater harvest is pictured by the fall holy days, the latter. The world has basically set aside, at least for the present time, they have set aside the teaching of the biblical holy days. And for that reason, they don't understand that this is not the only day of salvation. It is a day of salvation, certainly. And it is a day of salvation for those whom God has elected to call at this time. But as we can see, God has not elected to call everyone at this time. But there is a time when He will. And that is the key to understand what Calvinistic theology overlooks. That theology also fails to factor in the resurrections of the dead. What purpose would they have if it weren't to give people an opportunity that they didn't have in their lifetimes? What's wrong with Calvinism? I think we can boil it down to one basic thing. Calvinism is of the opinion that there are those who are predestined to be called and those who are not. Those who are predestined to be called have the opportunity for salvation. Those who are not can't and never will. What's wrong with that is the basic fact that all are destined to be called. That's what we understand. And that's what the resurrections teach us, and that's what the holy days teach us. All are destined to be called. It's a matter of when. There are those to be called early, and there are those to be called later. I submit to you that predestination does not exclude anyone. It simply defines the difference between those who are to be called now and those who are to be called later. Now, predestination theology, according to Calvin, focused on those who are destined to be called to salvation, but they are reluctant to apply that term to those who are not. Now, if someone is predestined to be called, can't we say that those who are not destined to be called are predestined to not be called? Is that a fair statement? Well, wouldn't it have to be? Let me throw another idea out to you. There are those who are destined to be called now, and there are those who are destined to be called later. Those who are to be called now, we could say, are predestined. Those who are not, we could say, are postdestined. Can we not? Is that illogical? Let's look at some scriptures. And I want to look at the original Greek, not so much its translated version. But the word that is translated predestined is not used all that often. I count about 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, about 6 or 7 places. But the first is in Acts 2:25, which says, "For David speaks concerning him. He says, I foresaw the Lord always before my face, for he is on my right hand, that I should not be moved." The word foresaw is the Greek pruraro or prurizo. There's two different versions of the word. But David foresaw something, which means he knew something was coming in the future. That is one of the possible meanings of this word. The next one is in Acts 21:29, which says, "For they had seen before with him in the city Trophimus, an Ephesian, whom they supposed that Paul had brought into the temple. That word supposed is again the same word that is later translated predestined. We can see that the word has a sense to it. It's a sense where you can see something in advance, or you can suppose something, or you can foresee something. God can certainly foresee. Acts 4:28 is another place where it says, "For to do whatsoever thy hand and thy counsel determined before to be done." Determined before is the Greek prorizo. A person can determine in advance what they're going to do. And I think by looking at these other places, we can get the greater sense of what this word means. But it's Romans 8:29 and 30 where a lot of the predestination thinking comes from. And let's go and read that verse. Those are particularly good. Romans 8:29 and 30. "For whom he did foreknow, he also did predestinate to be conformed to the image of his Son, that he might be the firstborn among many brethren. Moreover, whom he did predestinate, them he also called. And whom he called, them he also justified. And whom he justified, them he also glorified." There's a lot of meat in those few verses. Let's go back and look at it carefully. For whom he did foreknow, God knew something in advance. That is a given. That we can accept. God does know certain things in advance. Question is, what does he know? "But those he knew, he also did predestinate to be conformed to the image of his Son." Here we see predestination is not necessarily referring to their being called. He's referring to what they will become. God has laid out a plan in advance. It isn't where he's going to get people saved and at the end of their lives have all of these people say, "Oh, I don't know what we're going to do now. I mean, we've been concentrating all our time and effort on getting them saved. Now what?" No, God knows the now what. He has a plan for humanity, and the plan is that we're to be conformed to the image of his Son. This verse isn't talking so much about a person being called in the sense of being destined to be called as opposed to others who aren't. This is talking about what they will become once they are conformed to the image of his Son. And then look at the next phrase, "that he might be the firstborn among many brethren." Christ shows us from his own living experience what is to become of those who are called earlier, who are predestined. Their destiny is not in question. It's the timing of their calling that is. Some are destined to be called early, some later. And then, those whom he has called in this early segment of humanity, we could say, them he also called. He did the calling. Yes, that's right. Calvin was right at least that far. He, God, does the calling. And as we know from John 6:44, no man can come except the Father draw him. And what's the basis of that? We don't know. And I'm sure there's many of us can say, "I don't know why God called me. I can think of people who are better character, have better character than I have, who have more talents than I have, who would make a better Christian than I am." We know people like that. But for some reason, God hasn't called them. He's called the weak of the world. Now, we suspect to show that it's him doing it, not us. It's not our own greatness. But that's an aside. But God has called a few, a representative few right now. And that puts a great burden on each one of us, knowing that this is our opportunity. This is the time when the household of God is under evaluative judgment. This is our time. It's not the world's. Their day will come later. Them, those who he knew, I'm back in Romans 8, those whom he knew, he also called. And whom he called, them he also justified. And whom he justified, them he also glorified. Speaking of the future as an accomplished fact, it is our destiny to be glorified, to be made spirit beings as he was, following his example as the firstborn among many brethren, right there in that same verse. Let's go on to 1 Corinthians 2:7. 1 Corinthians 2:7, but we speak the wisdom of God in a mystery, even the hidden wisdom which God ordained before the world to our glory. And that word ordained before is again the Greek purizo. God planned it out long in advance, before this world even came into being. He had his plan. He knew what he was going to do. It's a mystery to us in many respects. But God predetermined, he preordained, he ordained before what this whole process was going to produce. And Ephesians 1:5 is another passage, and this is one that we referred to many times when I was reading that section from explaining the Calvinistic position. But let's go to Ephesians 1. And there's several verses there, focusing on verse 5, but let's start earlier than that. I'm going to start in verse 3. And this is a passage that Calvin relied on pretty heavily. Blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, who has blessed us with all spiritual blessings in heavenly places in Christ, according as he has chosen us in him before the foundation of the world, that we should be holy and without blame before him in love. What's the plan? That his people would be holy, without blame before him in love. It isn't so much who in that verse as it is what. Those who he has called, the elect. The plan was for them to be made holy and without blame before him. Having predestinated us unto the adoption of children by Jesus Christ to himself according to the good pleasure of his will. We can see how Calvinists might draw the conclusions that they do reading this passage of Scripture. But there's the two basic elements that they don't understand. Number one is all are destined to be called. It's a question of when. That it's not the only, this is not the only day of salvation. It is a day of salvation. But as we understand from the biblical holy days, there is another. Verse 6, to the praise of the glory of his grace, wherein he has made us accepted in the Beloved, in whom we have redemption through his blood, the forgiveness of sins according to the riches of his grace. Wherefore he has abounded toward us in all wisdom and prudence, having made known unto us the mystery of his will, according to his good pleasure, which he has purposed in himself. This is still Ephesians 1. that in the dispensation, verse 10, of the fullness of times, he might gather together in one all things in Christ, both which are in heaven and which are in earth, even in him. God is drawing together a contingent of people for his family. That is his plan. And for those who are destined to be called early, that is what will happen. The doctrine of predestination is built upon the foundational premise that predestination involves whether or not a person is destined to be saved. It's commonly held that some are and some are not. In other words, they have no choice at all in the matter and can do nothing to change it. The faulty premises of that thinking is that there is only one day of salvation. And that theology has no place for the resurrection of the dead. It holds the view of an ever-burning hell, which is another subject. But the biggest thing of all is the fact that all are destined to be called. It's a matter of when. So that brings us to the question, does mankind have a choice? In other words, does mankind really have free moral agency? Number one, when it comes to being called, and number two, when we're called. Is it automatic? Is it a foregone conclusion that someone who is God's elect, called of God, will make it no matter what? Now, that's another component of that kind of thinking. That we can effectively do nothing to cause ourselves to lose salvation. Once you're saved, man, you're locked in. That's it. Doesn't matter what you do after that. You don't need to keep God's laws. You can live an immoral life. As long as you keep it hidden, I suppose. Other people might have a problem with that. But is that how it is? Well, let's look at some patterns as it involves this choice question. One of the very first things that God did with Adam was he gave him the challenge to choose the names of all the animals. You can read that in Genesis 2, 19 to 20. The very first lesson, you could say, that God gave Adam is he wanted him to make choices, choices that came out of his own mind. He had to be inventive. Can you imagine having to name 30,000 different kinds of animals? Wouldn't you run out of names? God gave Adam the choice. He didn't tell him what to call those animals. One of the earliest messages we get in Genesis is that there are choices in life. There's choices to make. We can say this wasn't particularly consequential as it relates to salvation. No. But it's the thing. God gave man choice right from the beginning. In Genesis 2:24, man was left to choose to leave his own family and go establish his own. For this sake shall he leave father and mother and cleave unto his wife. There's that scripture, and that's in Genesis 2, that talks about that. He was given a choice of when to do that and simply to do it. And there was another major choice. And this one does affect the opportunity for salvation. Man was given a prohibition against eating of the tree of life. The choices became more and more consequential. Is there an underlying message in there? God expects we make choices. Now that would apply to salvation as well, would it not? God can call a person. But there's no guarantee they're going to respond. And if they respond, there's no guarantee that they're going to carry through to the end. And there are many scriptures that talk about that phenomenon. Now, we can say that there's people who are not called and don't have the mind to accept the calling if they were given one. Those, I believe, God would leave aside, knowing that they couldn't make it in this time. But those who can make it, those who can make it, they are the ones that God will call. But it's still up to them whether they respond or not. In Deuteronomy 30, verse 19, God says, I set before you life and death. He says, choose life. Could that be clearer? This instruction demonstrates that there is a choice we are called upon to make. And that choice, in many instances, can involve life or death. That doesn't mean that all people are afforded the same choice or opportunity at this time. But life is awarded based on our choice and our follow-through. That's important. John 5:22, God says, the Father has committed all judgment unto the Son. What would be the basis of judgment if there was no choice? There was nothing to judge. God would have to judge himself for consigning people to whatever deeds they commit because he didn't give them any choice to not commit them. And when you think about it, isn't predestination a form of prejudgment? Think about that. The Father disassociated himself from the activity of judging. We could speculate as to why. But there is the verse that says that Christ learned by the experience of having been born of the human life form. The Father never experienced physical life. If you were going to be judged for something, wouldn't you want to be judged by someone who has shared many of the same experiences as you? Does that show any of the wisdom of God? The idea of condemnation of a person who have never had any choice perverts the whole idea of judgment. It's very profound when you think about it. And then there's that verse that says, many are called and few are chosen. Matthew 20:16 and 22:14. Many are called, but few are chosen. What's the difference? Is the difference based on their personal choices? That's what we need to ask ourselves. 1 Timothy 1:19, there's the passage that says, many have made shipwreck. And I think either the last time or the time before that I spoke, we looked at that verse. This suggests that some people sailed their ship of life into the rocks. They weren't sailing properly. It was their own choice. It was their own fault that they lost out on their opportunity because of what they decided to do, of how they decided to sail their personal ship. And we spoke of John 6:44, where it says, no man can come except the Father draw him. That's profound in its own right. Does this preclude anyone coming unless they are specifically drawn? It would seem to say that. But where does that leave the vast majority? Well, there are many religious people in the world. They do their best to come to God, to seek conversion. They do their best. Very religious in many cases. We can be surprised at their devotion, but they don't understand the truth. Somehow there's a barrier, and there's many important truths that they just can't understand. What can we say of them? My personal feeling is that they are destined to be called later, and they are being primed for it. Even though they may not achieve it at this point, they are being primed for it. And they're going to be ready. They're going to be in the vanguard when that opportunity does come to them in that millennial era that we understand is pictured by the fall holy day season. Because, you see, there is another point in time. There are religious hymns that express this sentiment, but it's the sentiment of whosoever wills may come. Revelation 22:17 shows the Spirit and the bride inviting people to come. Whoever wills. It's wide open, but we need to understand in what time frame that is. And we can see the time frame for it in John chapter 7, verse 37. And let me brush by this quickly. John 7, 37. Now it was in verse in John 6, 44 that we saw that no man can come unless the Father draw him. And that was stated in the spring season. That was stated around Passover time. But in 7:37, we can read John chapter 7, verse 2, we can see that the Jews' Feast of Tabernacles was at hand. We have changed seasons here. And in a different season, there's a different criteria. Verse 37. In the last day, that great day of the feast, if we're not aware of what the time frame of this is, we've had it given to us twice here. Jesus stood up and cried, saying, "If any man thirst, let him come unto me and drink. He that believes on me, out of the scriptures, as the scriptures have said, out of his belly shall flow rivers of living water." God's Spirit is going to be available to whosoever wills in that time frame. In that second day of salvation, the day that is pictured by the millennial age, when Satan is going to be restrained. Satan is going to be removed from society. You can read that in Revelation chapter 20. What do you think a person's chances would be of being converted in that situation? And from that we can see how that God's consigning certain people to the later age is merciful because it gives them a much greater opportunity for salvation than they would have if they were called in this evil generation. God has called us not to give us any kind of smug reaction. In fact, it's rather challenging, it's rather intimidating that we are called now. And the fact tells us that God sees in us that we can make it if we want. But we have choices to make. Let me go back to the original question. Is salvation our choice? We could answer yes and no. In one respect, no, it's not. But in another respect, it is. Because to a calling, there has to be a response. God chooses who will be called in this age. But we must choose to respond, whether acceptingly or neglectfully. It's not a foregone conclusion. Hebrews 2, chapter 3, tells us something about that. Hebrews 2, verse 3. I'm going to start in verse 1. "Therefore we ought to give the more earnest heed to the things which we have heard, lest at any time we should let them slip. For if the word spoken by angels was steadfast, and every transgression and disobedience received a just recompense of reward, how shall we escape if we neglect so great salvation, which at the first began to be spoken by the Lord and was confirmed unto us by them that heard him? It is possible to neglect one's calling. That would be our choice. God doesn't assign us to failure once he's called us. Whether we carry through or not is up to us. God chooses to call those who are called earlier based on his foreknowledge that they can make it. God knows our hearts. He knows that not all can make it. No matter how religious or how good character they may express outwardly, he knows whether we can make it or not. He knows our circumstance. He knows the pressures that are going to be brought upon us. He knows the likelihood of our success. But if a person is called, we can know one thing. God believes we can make it. Those who can't, he leaves them uncalled. And that, in places like Romans 11:32, is referred to as mercy. Now think about that statement, Romans 11. Think about that statement in the context of Calvinistic thinking. If someone is not called, how could that possibly be called mercy if they're going to be consigned to hell? That's what a Calvinist would think. Let's look at that verse, 11, verse 32. I'm going to go up to verse 30. For as you in times past have not believed God, yet have now obtained mercy through their unbelief, even so have these also now not believed, that through your mercy they also may obtain mercy. For God has concluded them all in unbelief, that he might have mercy upon all. Now, if God is concluding someone into an unbelieving state, how can that remotely be considered merciful? If that means that they're never going to be given a chance for salvation, if they are automatically going to be barred from salvation and consigned to an ever-burning hell, how can that possibly be mercy? There's obviously something here that we don't understand. And it can be explained very easily by the early and the latter rains. There is a smaller harvest that God is calling out of humanity now, at this time. And there's another harvest that is going to be called later. The rewards are higher in this calling, because those who are called now are going to be co-ruling with Jesus Christ in his kingdom. And he's going to use them to educate the rest of humanity. First, those living, those who live on over through the Great Tribulation into the millennial age, are going to be taught by Christ's elect, made spirit in the first resurrection. But there is another resurrection that's going to come after the 1,000 years, and Revelation 20 will explain that. What's that for? That is to give opportunity to those people who have died who never legitimately had it. That's the key that answers all of these questions. That's what we need to understand. Those who are predestined are destined to be called prior to the rest. And those who are to be called later are, we could say, post-destined. But the key to understanding is the fact that all are destined to be called. It's a matter of when. Hopefully this will clear up the matter. Yes, we have choices. Once we're called, boy, do we have choices. And those choices have serious consequences, as we can read. But no, God is not pre-consigning anyone to death and destruction. That is the fruit of our own choices. Hope that helps.